KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Many of Donald Trump's day one promises need congressional approval. On this inauguration day, we ask House Democrat Jamie Raskin about the pursuit of common ground. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Former Trump advisor Steve Bannon says tech CEOs attending the inauguration are there as supplicants. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Our colleague Steve Inskeep speaks with Bannon about the incoming administration and Trump's relationship with Silicon Valley. Also, the day after Trump's first inauguration, millions of people protested in D.C. and around the U.S. At another protest this past weekend, far fewer people took part. It's Monday, January 20th. Today in 2015, history had its eyes on the musical Hamilton, which premiered in New York City. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President-elect Trump takes the oath of office in 2 hours at the U.S. Capitol. Last hour, Trump, Vice President-elect J.D. Vance, and their families attended a service at St. John's Episcopal Church close to the White House. The church service is a nearly century-old tradition for incoming presidents. Later today, Trump is expected to sign several executive orders. One is going to say that it's U.S. policy to recognize two biologically distinct sexes, male and female. This order can affect documents such as passports, visas, and employee records. A second order will end all diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in the federal government. An incoming White House official says Trump is going to sign an executive order declaring a national emergency. That's intended to cut regulations for the energy industry. The order is supposed to end the, quote, electric vehicle mandate. Trump is also going to declare a national emergency at the U.S. border. He is expected to take several actions around this. These include efforts to suspend refugee resettlement in the U.S. for 4 months. It also calls for restoring the death penalty for people in the U.S. illegally who kill a law enforcement officer. Trump will also seek to end a constitutional amendment known as birthright citizenship. This last action is expected to see an immediate legal challenge. Supporters of President-elect Trump are preparing to celebrate his inauguration. NPR's Sarah McCammon reports some traveled hundreds of miles for the event they hoped to witness, only to find that it was moved indoors because of cold weather.
Michael Webb and Jonathan Mahoney were excited for the inauguration, but they're rolling with the change of plans.
I got moved inside, so it's kind of sad.
Yeah, we had tickets too, so we were like on the lawn, and then we don't know what's going on with that now.
Webb, who's from Texas, and Mahoney from Massachusetts, are in the military and stationed together a few hours from D.C. Edwin Alas traveled from Colorado with his husband, Gabriel. Alas says they don't have tickets, but they wanted to come celebrate the new president.
You want the best for him, because a successful presidency, no matter what party, is a successful country. So we hope the same for President Trump.
Trump will take the oath inside the Capitol Rotunda, with many supporters watching from a downtown arena. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Washington.
Meanwhile, this morning, President Biden has issued several pardons. He says these are meant to protect certain Americans from politically motivated prosecutions. The pardons are for former Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley, the former pandemic medical advisor to the White House, Dr. Anthony Fauci, and pardons for lawmakers on the House January 6th committee and their staff. You're listening to NPR. The National Weather Service has issued warnings of extreme cold in the central U.S. from the Canadian border down to South Texas. At the same time, a winter storm is brewing on the Gulf Coast. Heavy snow, sleet, and freezing rain are headed for Texas, Georgia, and Florida. Forecasters say these areas don't often get this kind of winter weather. Canada's internal trade minister says if President-elect Trump follows through on his threat of tariffs, Canada could retaliate with the single largest trade blow to the U.S. Dan Karpinchuk reports Anita Anand says Canada is ready to take on Trump immediately.
Anand says retaliatory measures are ready and will be unveiled on Monday when and if Trump slaps a 25% tariff on Canadian products. She's echoed what other cabinet ministers and nearly all provincial premiers have said, that Canada will use all the tools it has to ensure that Canadian workers and industry are protected. Trump has praised the use of tariffs, but economic experts are warning that his threat would have devastating effects on both economies, especially if there is a trade war, the biggest between Canada and the U.S. in decades. Anand also acknowledges that Ottawa still does not have any information about what Trump will do, but she says Canada has planned multiple rounds of counter-tariffs, which it will not hesitate to use. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
California firefighters are making progress against the two enormous wildfires burning around Los Angeles, but powerful Santa Ana winds that have helped fuel the flames are returning today. Forecasters have issued a red flag warning. The winds are expected to last through Thursday. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Donald Trump is prepared to sign 10 immigration-related executive orders once he's sworn in as president later today. That's what incoming White House officials told reporters. NPR's immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo was on the call. So, Jimena, break it down. What did Trump officials announce today?
This morning, incoming White House officials previewed 10 executive orders. They ranged from declaring a national emergency at the southern border to designating criminal cartels as terrorists. He also plans to bring back items from his first term. He vowed to reinstitute Remain in Mexico. This was a policy from his first term that would require some asylum seekers at the southern border to wait in Mexico for their asylum hearings in U.S. immigration court, and resume construction of the border wall. Some of his biggest and boldest promises are also on the list. This includes making moves to end birthright citizenship and deploying the military and National Guard to the southern border as well. The official also said that U.S. would be suspending refugee resettlement for at least 4 months. Officials said that they're planning to end asylum entirely and close the border to those without legal status via proclamation, which, quote, creates an immediate removal process without the possibility of asylum.
So, Jimena, this is all pretty much what we've been hearing for the last few months.
Correct. We expected a lot of this. Last night, during a rally in Washington, D.C., Trump said that he planned to sign these executive orders quickly and launch, quote, the most aggressive, sweeping effort to restore the nation's borders that the world has ever seen. That's what he said. A lot of these have been campaign promises as well. Immigration, as we know, was a huge issue during the election. Every rally, Trump dedicated time to the issue and even vowed that these would be his day one executive orders.
Okay, so that's some of what what we know? What do we not know?
There's still much that remains to be seen about how much of these efforts will literally and physically work. Some of them, such as Remain in Mexico, will, you know, bring back policy that was previously on the books. But other actions, such as moving to revoke birthright citizenship, are brand new and come with plenty of legal complexities. You know, taking that as the example, birthright citizenship, which is enshrined in the 14th Amendment, would need a constitutional amendment that is going to be really difficult in this political climate. That requires 3/4 of states to be approved. Several of these actions will also be subject to legal challenges from states or immigrants' rights organizations, or need Congress to mobilize new funding.
Okay. Now, how popular are some of these proposed measures?
Well, Trump campaigned on this, so people knew what he was planning to do. Still, the latest NPR PBS Marist poll finds that Americans are evenly split on whether to mass deport people in the United States who are here without legal status, though divisions do fall along party lines.
Okay, last thing, Jimena. So how quickly will these or any of these go into effect?
They may take weeks or months to implement. Several actions, again, will likely be subject to legal challenges or need that funding from Congress that Trump currently does not have. In fact, even quickly scaling up operations might be difficult for the new administration. A previous NPR investigation last year found that U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the agency responsible for removals, struggled to scale up to Trump's immediate demands during his first term, which included attempts to increase deportations. And Congress must provide the Department of Homeland Security and other agencies with a lot of more funding to execute the policies. In their final budget, the Biden administration asked for $19 billion to fund additional personnel, facilities, more to build up other enforcement resources along the southwest border. Lawmakers are expected to take up border security funding as a part of a bigger budget-related measure, but that's not till later this year.
All right, that was a lot. Thank you. That's NPR's Jimena Bustillo.
Thank you.
In the final hours of President Biden's term, he issued preemptive pardons for members and staff of the bipartisan select committee that investigated the attack 4 years ago on the U.S. Capitol. The pardons extended to the Capitol police officers who testified, along with officials who served under Trump but became vocal critics, former Joint Chiefs Chair, retired General Mark Milley, and Dr. Anthony Fauci, now retired from the National Institutes of Health. Biden says even though they did nothing wrong and would eventually be exonerated of wrongdoing, he took the extraordinary step to protect them from the next president's retribution. That was from his statement. Both Milley and Fauci publicly thanked him for the pardons. Also on that pardon list is Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, who serves as the top Democrat on the House Oversight Committee and was a member of the select committee that investigated the January 6th attack. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Hey, good morning.
So are you going to accept the pardon?
Well, it's a sign of our strange times that public officials and public servants have to be pardoned just for doing their jobs and upholding their oath of office and upholding the law. So we just learned about this about an hour ago. And so we're all digesting the news at this point.
Have you made the decision, though, on whether to accept it or not?
Well, I don't even know whether that's a choice, and I'm going to consult lawyers about that. It's not clear to me that a pardon is something you reject or you accept. I think it is a statement of the law, but I'm just not sure.
Well, I'm asking because in the past we'd heard Senator Adam Schiff, a member of your party, say that these pardons would set the wrong precedent. Former Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who was on the select committee with you, who said he didn't want and wouldn't accept a pardon. He said taking the pardon would make a person look guilty of something. Did the president overstep with these pardons?
Now, look, obviously, it's a strange thing for pardons to issue for people who've just done their job and have not committed any offense or wrongdoing. On the other hand, President Trump has been making very explicit threats against the chair of our committee, Benny Thompson, and against Liz Cheney, the vice chair of our committee. I think we have a lot of protection from the speech and debate clause against prosecution, but I can see people being of mixed mind about whether or not a pardon helps. The key thing for me is that going forward, we are going to be able to stand up strong for the Constitution, for the rule of law, and defend the rights of the people. And so to the extent that it removes a distraction, then I think, it seems fine. But to me, given that the speech and debate clause already immunizes us against federal and state prosecution, as well as civil lawsuits for our work as legislators, it doesn't seem to me to be that big a deal.
Now, I spoke to Congressman Byron Donalds earlier, a representative from Florida in the House, and he, like other Republicans, said he was really concerned. I want to play what he said about the pardons.
What this really demonstrates is the fact that they knew that they were doing things that were wrong. Number one, you're not allowed to destroy evidence in a congressional hearing. That is against federal law. So by Joe Biden providing these pardons to those staffers and, frankly, the members of those committee, he once again is subverting the law.
What's your reaction to that and that insinuation?
It's absolutely absurd. We destroyed no evidence, and all of the evidence from all of our committees is available to everybody online, and nobody has laid a glove on the report of the January 6th committee. It's a more than 800-page report, and nobody has contradicted a single factual conclusion that our bipartisan committee produced. So I imagine it's absurd rhetoric like that that impelled the president to make his decision. We have got to move on from this. There was an attempted violent insurrection against the government and an attempt to overthrow a presidential election. Our committee report definitively and exhaustively reported on everything that happened. Nobody has contradicted any of the facts in there. And the idea that they're going to, you know, try to prosecute Liz Cheney or Benny Thompson or any of us is just absurd.
Now, the new administration comes in today. The Republicans control the House by a thin minority, also control the Senate. How do you see Democrats' role in this moment, and how do you find common ground with Republicans?
Yeah, and the Republicans have the slenderest majority in the House in many decades. It's going to end up being 217 to 215, which means they can afford to lose only one vote. And I think they've already effectively lost several, at least as guaranteed votes for what they want to do. Look, I think it's a time of a lot of ideological fluidity and complexity on the right wing in America. And there are huge conflicts that have opened up between, people like Steve Bannon and the tech broligarchs, as they call them now, who have a completely different position on a whole range of issues. And so I think there are ways we can get together. On the Judiciary Committee, where I'm now the ranking member, I'm hopeful that Chairman Jordan and I can work together again on reviving the Press Act, which was legislation to protect reporters against compulsory production of their confidential sources and notes. We sponsored that together. It passed unanimously in the committee and in the House. It faltered in the Senate, but I'm hoping we get that through. I think we should ban individual stock trading in Congress. I think we can get together on that. And I think, look, Donald Trump is very proud of the fact that he won not just in the Electoral College, but in the popular vote by more than 3 million votes. Like, I know Joe Biden was proud that he won by more than 7 million votes when he beat Trump 4 years ago. Why don't we use this as an opportunity to move to a national popular vote for president? Let's get rid of the Electoral College, which is an accident waiting to happen all the time. So I think, in fact, there are lots of things we could do working together over the next few years.
And thank you for correcting me. I misspoke. The Republicans obviously have a thin lead in the House. Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, thank you for your time.
You bet.
This is NPR News.
President-elect Donald Trump will be sworn in for a second term in the White House on Martin Luther King Day. On the next Fresh Air, we'll speak with scholars Tressie McMillan Cottom and Eddie Glaude to talk about what lies ahead and the legacy of Dr. King. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From the estate of Jane Gross, whose bequest supports NPR's commitment to creating a more informed public by distributing programming that meets the highest standards of public service and journalism. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at metamucil.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This Inauguration Day is not unfolding exactly as Steve Bannon would like. Bannon is the sometime Donald Trump advisor who influenced his victory in 2016 and later urged Trump supporters to seize power in the Republican Party. These days, he produces many hours of video live streaming his right-wing view of the world from a townhouse here in Washington, D.C.
War Room. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Last Friday, I was sitting with Steve Bannon while he was live on the air, and he had to interrupt a guest on the line.
Hey, Jason, can you give people, I got breaking news here.
His expression said the news wasn't good.
Yeah, I don't know about this, man. Due to the dangerously cold temperatures expected Monday, President-elect Trump's inauguration is moving indoors, sources tell.
Which Bannon felt showed a lack of grit.
Let's get back up. It ain't going to be that cold. Is this because the oligarchs are there? Are they too tender coming from Silicon Valley? Are they too soft? They can't sit in the cold? Then don't come. Sign the surrender document somewhere else.
Bannon signed off and turned to his producer.
Oh, my God, stop. Please, no praying.
They're talking about moving the
Did Trump, please tell me Trump didn't agree with this.
The producer read aloud a Truth Social post showing Trump did agree. This moment showed Bannon in microcosm. He's a devoted Trump supporter who also has his own vision of where the world should go. He's an advocate of political combat who went to prison last year rather than cooperate with a congressional investigation of Trump's bid to overturn his 2020 election defeat. And he's eager to battle the tech leaders Trump invited to today's ceremony. Bannon uses the same word for them that President Biden did in his farewell speech.
And they're clearly oligarchs. They have concentration of wealth and power.
I had a long talk with Bannon, which shows some of the tensions in Trump's coalition. The billionaires do business around the world, seemingly the kind of globalists that Trump rails against. Bannon is openly nativist, eager to see Trump crack down on immigration.
That's why we're not going to see 100 executive orders on Monday. We'll probably see, I don't know, 50.
And Bannon is focused on legal as well as illegal immigration.
There is no legal immigration to this country.
No legal immigration?
It's all gained. It's all corrupt. You can't.
Bannon was sitting in front of a fireplace decorated with a picture of Jesus Christ, a Moms for Liberty travel mug, and a sign reading, "There are no conspiracies, but there are no coincidences." Words attributed to Stephen K. Bannon. The room was cluttered with newspapers and books, like one in favor of India's nationalist prime minister and one warning against artificial intelligence. TV monitors on the wall showed that day's Senate confirmation hearings and TV cameras in the room aimed at Bannon. He says he's not going into the second Trump administration, but plans to have a voice. Do you talk much to Trump these days?
Enough, and he watches the show.
Bannon is live streaming 4 hours per weekday and two more on Saturday, 22 hours per week.
You know, I've chosen to do this, right? So it's what I do. I get up.
Though he made a fortune working at Goldman Sachs and in Hollywood, the 71-year-old says he draws on his working-class roots to fire up activists.
This show is built for people's human agency.
As part of its working-class pitch, Bannon calls for higher taxes on the wealthy, although Trump has done the opposite. A big theme of Bannon's show is the 2020 election. A regular guest, Mike Lindell, the pillowmaker, said just last week the election was stolen.
And I want everybody to know I have a 90-page report coming out with my election bureau.
And saying he will release proof soon, which he's been saying for years.
Bannon himself is in a unique position. 8 years ago, he was Trump's wealthy advisor, pushing dramatic moves like what was known as the Muslim ban. Today, Trump has a far wealthier advisor, Elon Musk. Bannon explains Trump's embrace of the billionaires by saying they surrendered to Trump, who's putting his trophies on display today.
We will break all these guys eventually. They're broken right now because what's happening on Monday with the tech oligarchs.
Indoors or outdoors, whatever.
God, I wanted it outdoors and make them freeze. I'm really upset about that. They're not there because they support Trump. They're there because the Trump movement and President Trump broke them.
Bannon acknowledged that Musk is in a special category. He embraced Trump sooner than others, invested hundreds of millions of dollars in Trump's victory, and now, like Bannon, wants to hack away at the federal government. And yet, you've been very critical of him in recent days. Why?
Number one, it came up to a head about the H-1B visas.
Mm-hmm.
We're populist. We believe American citizens should come first in everything.
Musk, the South African immigrant, spoke up for a visa program that lets U.S. firms bring in high-skilled engineers and others, which Musk says is good for America. Bring in the talent like a sports team. Bannon rejects that whole idea.
Why are we trying to be an imperial power? Why they say we need the best and the brightest? Well, hold it. The best and the brightest got to come from American citizens. I don't want to sit here and take the world's best and most elite and biggest brains and put them in the United States. What's going to make their countries better?
Bannon has called Musk, quote, truly evil. He was upset when Musk wrote approvingly of somebody's social media post, a post that used a word many people find offensive to describe American workers. This feels like way more than a disagreement about H-1B.
No, it's a fundamental chasm. Let's go back to H-1B. Here's what upset me and why I got engaged in it. He called the American citizens retards, the R word. He dissed the MAGA movement as being racist, which is the old trope that the left used to do. He used all the left tropes to come after us. These oligarchs in the Silicon Valley, they have a very different view of how people should govern themselves. I call it techno-feudalism. They don't believe in the underlying tenets of self-governance.
But as Trump finalized his plans for the tech lord's centric inauguration, the president-elect told an interviewer he favored H-1B visas.
President Trump and I disagree on this. He adamantly disagrees with me on this.
What does it say that Trump listened to the people you consider to be oligarchs and not to you?
Well, hang on for a second. Why do you say he's listened? Just because he said, I think
he agreed with them and not with you.
Let's see how that plays out.
You suggest a scenario where Trump is effectively using these tech leaders. They're up on stage with him. They're totems of his triumph. Are you sure he's not using you, though? That it might be the reverse? That they're going to get what they want out of this, and you're not?
This is all a process, right? This is a populist nationalist revolution in this country. It's been building for a long time.
The inauguration is a beginning, not an end. Many people believe Trump can be influenced, flattered, persuaded, which helps to explain why wealthy people who had doubts about Trump are engaging and donating now. Steve Bannon is engaging too, pushing Trump toward his particular right-wing vision. This is NPR News.
As President-elect Trump prepares to take the oath of office for his second term, some religious leaders see his return to the White House as a divine act.
President Trump, you were born into the world to be a trumpet of God, a vessel of the Lord in the hands of God.
The comparison worries some scholars. We'll hear why on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Guests are arriving at the U.S. Capitol for Donald Trump's inauguration as the 47th president. Trump and his wife, Melania Trump, have been meeting at the White House with President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden. Trump will take his oath of office in about 90 minutes during an indoor ceremony at the U.S. Capitol. Trump is promising a flurry of executive orders, including 10 focused on border security and immigration. One would declare a national emergency at the southern border. Another would reinstate the Remain in Mexico policy. President Biden has issued pardons to members of the January 6th committee, Dr. Anthony Fauci and General Mark Milley. They and others have been verbally targeted by President-elect Trump and his allies, as NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
In a statement, Biden said the people he is pardoning are public servants who, quote, do not deserve to be the targets of unjustified and politically motivated prosecutions. In addition to the high-profile names, Biden said he is also pardoning staff who assisted the January 6th committee with its work and members of law enforcement who testified about what happened on the day 4 years ago Trump supporters stormed the Capitol. Trump said he believes in the rule of law, but these are exceptional circumstances. And he said the issue of these pardons should not be mistaken as an acknowledgement of wrongdoing or an admission of guilt. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News. Ukraine Security Service says it's detained a Ukrainian lawyer accused of recruiting agents to spy for Russia. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv that the arrest comes as Russia continues to capture Ukrainian land.
Writing on the social media app Telegram, Ukraine Security Service says its investigation shows Russia recruited the unnamed lawyer in 2015 and paid him for various tasks. He recruited more Ukrainians to spy for Russia, defended those spies in court, and also gave Russia information about Ukraine's domestic spy agency. The suspect is charged with high treason and faces life in prison. On Sunday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky also signed a decree implementing sanctions against several Ukrainian politicians accused of spreading Russian propaganda. Meanwhile, Russian forces say they have occupied two more villages in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News.
A 33-year-old police volunteer has been sentenced to life in an Indian prison. A court in Kolkata sentenced Sanjay Roy today in the rape and murder of a trainee doctor at the hospital where she worked. The crime last year sparked national outrage over the safety of women and led other doctors to remain off the job for weeks to demand justice for her. Roy has consistently maintained his innocence. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Sammy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. With the inauguration moving indoors, thousands waited in line this morning to get into the Capital One Arena in downtown Washington, where they can view the event on screen. That is also where President Trump will appear after he's sworn in the Capitol Rotunda. NPR's Frank Langfitt was out this morning chatting with people and standing in line to get into the arena. Good morning, Frank. Thanks
for being
here.
Hey, good morning, Leila.
So what was it like? Were people disappointed that they couldn't get to the inauguration in person?
I don't think they were that disappointed. I think people were just excited to be there. And it was quite a scene. It was block after block of people in these pedestrian barriers. And there are these vendors who are trying to sell them stuff. I was trying to talk to people. Secret Service were chasing us away. I did talk to this woman named Joanne Floyd. She's from Mississippi. And she tried to get into Capitol One yesterday for Trump's rally. And here's what happened.
Now, let me tell you this. Stood in line yesterday in the freezing cold to get in. And guess what? When we got about right to it, they said that it was at full capacity. I think a lot of people were breaking line.
Now, Leila, Floyd was disappointed and a bit mad that people were butting in front of her.
Right.
But she's optimistic she's going to get to see Trump today in person. And that would make her one of the lucky Trump supporters because Capital One only has a capacity of about 20,000 people.
Yeah, but the news the inauguration was moving inside, that happened a few days ago and still people came. What brought them?
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, people often talk, his supporters, about a real connection to President Trump. What was so interesting today, Leila, is everybody talked policy to me. And the word that came up is what we're covering a lot today is immigration. I talked to this guy, Ethan Zhang. He's from Western China. He works in marketing in New York. He told me, you know, after the pandemic, that situation in New York had really deteriorated, and he blamed a lot of it on immigrants who are here and have no legal status. This is what Ethan said.
I used to live in Queens. My neighborhood used to be quiet. And when they got in, they play music very loud and they just don't respect anything, you know.
Now, you said Ethan's from Western China but working in the U.S. So isn't he also an immigrant?
He is. But what he says is he did this all legally. He filled out a lot of paperwork. He's got a green card. He's going to become a citizen next year. And he says he resents people who have entered the country without permission. And I heard that from other people, too, today. There was a woman who's a lawyer in San Antonio. Her family's originally from Argentina. She said something similar. Another thing that was interesting, Leila, is I asked Ethan. He's been here, I think, about a decade in the States. He said this is his first inauguration, and this is one of the reasons he said why.
Before, I didn't pay much attention about politics. Then I realized, you know, like, it involves Iowa of us.
This is Trump's second inauguration. The first one was in 2017. Did you talk to anyone who went to that one and came to this one?
Yeah, I did. And some people said that they've seen a difference. I talked to a woman named Amanda Travis. She's a respiratory therapist in Arizona. And she said back then in 2017, people here in Washington, of course, it's a very Democratic city. She felt they were very hostile towards her. Here's what she said.
When we came in 2017, we had a lot of hate, and then people scream at us, "We hate you, scum of the earth."
Really?
Yeah, we were really afraid. Yeah, we were really afraid. And then now, no. Even you can tell, even if people don't like Trump or they don't like it, they just give you a dirty look and they just walk on. They're not mean.
So what does she think changed?
Well, I talked to her about it, and she said, and the person that she was with said that they thought the success, as they saw it, of Trump's first term, but they also said that this time around that Trump had won the popular vote and that the victory seemed more legitimate nationally.
Well, thank you for reporting out in the freezing cold for us. That's NPR's Frank Langfitt. Thank you, Frank.
Happy to do it, Leila.
Turning now to the Middle East, where there was a chaotic scene of celebration in the West Bank last night.
Yeah, thousands of people greeted busloads of Palestinian prisoners and detainees freed from Israeli jail. That was after three Israeli women hostages held by Hamas were released earlier in the day, and they had emotional reunions with their families. And this is just the start of the first phase of what's being called a temporary ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
NPR's Adil Al-Shalchi has been covering the events from Tel Aviv, joins us now. So what was it like being there yesterday?
Well, after 15 months of grief, everyone was actually nervous it wouldn't happen. But then from the moment the ceasefire did go into effect, almost 3 hours late, you could feel this collective sigh of relief just blanket the country. It was a day of tears, jubilation, embraces for Israelis seeing the three hostages released, for Palestinians in Gaza who got a respite from the fighting, and for those in the West Bank reuniting with their imprisoned relatives.
Yeah, we just heard what it sounded like in that moment. What about the release of Palestinian detainees, which included women and minors in the West Bank?
Well, it was bitterly cold there, and families bundled up, waiting for hours, waving Palestinian flags. There was singing. People held balloons. People had also been confused for a long time about when and how the detainees were going to be released. My colleague Kat Lonsdorf was in Ramallah and told us that around 2 in the morning, buses pulled up and dozens of detainees got out. And then the crowd pushed and pulled, chanted, danced, and fireworks decorated the sky.
And you were in Israel at the hospital earlier when the three hostages were taken there from Gaza. What did you see there?
Yeah, so the hostages were Emily Damari, Romy Gonen, and Doron Steinbrecher, all between the ages of 24 and 31. They were brought in on helicopters. Some of their friends were there, and we could hear these shouts of happiness ring in the hospital halls when they saw each other. Emily Cohen spoke on behalf of the Damari family.
It's been the craziest emotional roller coaster for the families. It's only three of them that have come out, and so it's kind of bittersweet.
Okay, so now the ceasefire has held for more than 24 hours. What are you hearing from Palestinians inside Gaza?
Well, in the morning when the ceasefire took effect, Palestinians blasted their music from their homes. They cheered, honked their car horns, and then the skies went silent for the first time in months. The past few days had actually been some of the deadliest, with dozens killed in Israeli airstrikes. Also, we know that more than 600 trucks of desperately needed aid rolled into Gaza, according to the United Nations. And as Israeli troops partially withdrew from parts of the north, some displaced Palestinians made their way back to see what was left of their homes. Our producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, spoke with one of them. Here's Thamer Al-Akul. It's an unimaginable happiness, he says, like I stumbled on $1 million. But Hamas was very quick to send a message that it's still in charge of Gaza. We saw videos of Hamas police organizing aid distribution, patrolling the streets, and there were masked militants parading in the neighborhoods.
All right, so all this feels like a lot, Adil, but what do we expect to happen in the coming days?
This phase of the ceasefire is 6 weeks. Another swap is expected on Saturday. Hamas is supposed to release 4 more hostages. But you know, Palestinians in Gaza have suffered so much loss and devastation. Israelis are desperate to start healing from the worst attack on their country. So many people here just want the war to end.
Yeah, that's NPR's Adil Al-Shalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
President Trump's first inaugural, he painted a very grim picture of an American carnage. We'll get response to his second inaugural next time, here and now.
You're about to step out the door. You've got your keys, your wallet, and NPR. If you have your smartphone, we are with you. Listen live at this station's website or NPR.org.
Good morning, Martinez. It might be a stressful day at work for White House staff. For the moment, the outgoing and incoming presidents head to the Capitol together. Teams have about 5 hours to move the Bidens out and move the Trumps in. They also deep clean the residence, washing windows, vacuuming, or replacing carpets, and bringing in new mattresses, linens, and towels. By the time the Trumps return, everything will be in place, including their favorite foods in the kitchen. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Want to know if your body fat is in the healthy range? Well, stepping on a scale is not the best way to figure that out. International panel of experts is now recommending a more nuanced and objective way. Here's NPR's Allison Aubrey.
There's plenty of stigma associated with having a larger body size, and one common assumption is that everyone with a high BMI or body mass index is unhealthy and needs to lose weight. Kezia Reeder knows what it feels like to be categorized as obese.
I'm shorter and muscular. By no means am I like an Olympic athlete, but I'm athletic. At the time where my BMI was categorized as obese, I was running half marathons.
For many years, the main way doctors have determined whether a person has obesity is by calculating their BMI. It's a quick and inexpensive estimate based on just weight and height. Since stocky, muscular people weigh more, they tend to have higher BMIs.
It's enraging because I know I am a healthy, active individual.
Her lab tests showed she was metabolically healthy. Many experts agree BMI is not a good measure of health. Dr. Robert Kushner of Northwestern University was part of the panel that came up with the new recommendations.
40% of the adult population in America, according to BMI, has obesity. So do they all have a disease and do they all need treatment?
Dr. Kushner says the commission's goal is to bring some clarity to these questions, since the current method has led to misclassifications and confusion.
What's new is that we try to define obesity by excess body fat, which is what obesity actually is. That goes beyond just using BMI.
The commission recommends adding measures such as waist circumference or waist to hip ratio, or to use direct measures of body fat through screening techniques such as a DEXA scan when available and affordable. Dr. Kushner says the problem with BMI alone is that a person who is muscular and athletic like Kezia Reeder may be told they have obesity even if they have very little body fat.
So although we're not throwing out BMI, we are now recommending that individuals have another measurement obtained that more directly gets an estimate of body fat, such as waist circumference.
The reason there's a focus on weight around the middle of the body is that too much of it can be harmful.
Fat in the belly causes systemic inflammation, which then goes on and causes other metabolic problems like elevated blood sugar, elevated blood pressure, and increased fats in the blood.
Setting the stage for metabolic diseases, including diabetes as well as heart disease. The experts say this reframing of BMI offers a more nuanced and objective way to assess body composition. Kezia Reeder struggled with an eating disorder in college and has been in recovery for many years.
I have plenty of examples of how I felt stigma around my weight and or BMI being used as a measure of quote-unquote health.
She now works with the EMILY program, an eating disorder treatment center, and says she applauds the new recommended changes.
I'm really encouraged by medical providers and health systems moving away from using BMI as an indicator of health.
The aim is to move towards more personalized care, something she and the experts agree on. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. I'm from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands. With therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
Navigate politics at work.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing direct car insurance rates side by side with other insurance carriers. Customers can see rates and find an option that works for their needs. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer in for David Brancaccio. It is Martin Luther King Day. Today is also Inauguration Day, with Donald Trump officially starting his second term as president. Election season is, for the most part, over, but that doesn't mean political discussions stop, even when you go to work. After all, some people are saying the 2026 midterms are just around the corner. So what do you do if news or politics start impacting you at work? And how do you navigate those conversations safely at the office? Minnesota Public Radio correspondent Catherine Richard has been reporting on political polarization as part of the Talking Sense reporting project. And Catherine is here to tell us what she's learned. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Nancy.
So we're seeing more political tension in the workplace. Why is that?
Well, the experts I spoke with say it's because our personal identities have become so deeply entwined with our political beliefs. So it's really hard to leave that part of yourself at home when you show up for work every day. And on top of that, social media has made it easier for us to access information about our colleagues' political beliefs. You know, if your friend's on Facebook with your cubicle mate, they might post something about the election, you're going to see it, and maybe you're not going to like it.
People still have to work together, even if they disagree politically. So what can employers do about these tensions?
Well, if employers ignore these tensions, they may fester and then explode. And when there's distrust between colleagues, productivity can suffer. People might not want to collaborate together. Now, George Vergolius is the chief clinical officer for R3 Continuum. It's a company that provides behavioral health services to organizations facing workplace disruption. Vergolius says that it is possible for employers to create forums for productive conversations.
In an ideal scenario, what we want is to have both parties actually walk away with a deeper understanding of why the other person sees their views the way they do. We're not talking about converting the other side. That can occasionally happen, but it's rare. But the ability that I can understand your perspective, understand how you arrived there, and still see you as a human that has a bunch of wonderful qualities, even if I vehemently disagree with your political views, that's what we want ultimately.
Now, Vergolius says that some hallmarks of productive conversations are clear boundaries about what's on topic and what isn't. And people involved in these talks can ask curious questions. That's really helpful. And they're not going to try and change anyone's mind.
Well, that's all well and good, Catherine, but what if employees do cross those boundaries and they're not respectful? Does human resources need to get involved?
Yes, there's definitely a role for HR in these situations. I spoke with Tara Turk-Haynes. She's founder of Equity Activations.
So if you're working with someone who has these extreme political beliefs and they're spewing them to you in a way that actually doesn't have anything to do with work, and it goes against your policies of, you know, treating people with respect, or if it's derogatory, that's when you go to HR.
But Turk-Haynes stresses that there are ways to make sure it never actually gets to that point. You know, it's key for employee handbooks to have clear guidance around what's okay to talk about and what isn't okay to talk about at work. And she added that better training for managers to get out in front of these conflicts before they explode is also really important.
Minnesota Public Radio correspondent Catherine Richard, thanks.
You're welcome.
U.S. markets are closed today in observance of Martin Luther King Day. They reopen tomorrow at 9:30 a.m. Wall Street time. There's a lot going on in the global economy, even on a holiday when markets are closed. Listen later to my colleague Kai Rizdahl for today's developments, including the inauguration. Hear it live on many public radio stations at marketplace.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Glassdoor, announcing the best places to work in 2025 based on anonymous reviews from real employees. Learn who's leading the way in workplace culture and employee satisfaction, and see who's hiring at Glassdoor.com. And by Clear Channel Outdoor, an out-of-home billboard company that offers data-driven advertising solutions for businesses big and small. Billboardsforbusiness.com.
As fires continue to burn in Los Angeles, many people are going online to find ways to support those who have been temporarily or permanently displaced by the disaster. But as we've seen in the aftermath of recent hurricanes and floods, bad actors are spreading misinformation and financial scams. On our sister program, Marketplace Tech, my colleague Kimberly Adams spoke with Steve Grobman, Chief Technology Officer at the cybersecurity firm McAfee, to learn more. Here's Steve.
So a lot of what we've seen is, you know, number one, celebrities endorsing charities that don't actually exist. So we've seen the likes of Emma Watson and Kim Kardashian having fake accounts set up, representing them, talking about contributions in order to provide relief for the victims of this event. And in both cases, those were just completely fake. We've also seen the use of generative AI to misrepresent what's actually happening. Some of the most viral pictures that we've seen in this case are things like the Hollywood sign being engulfed in flames.
Are you seeing most of this misinformation, the deep fakes, being used just to extort money out of people or to push particular narratives and stories about the fires?
It's both. We see it being used to inflame what was done by government agencies, or in some cases, there's a religious undertone that the events are related to the politics or the social leanings of that particular part of the country. And unfortunately, we see all of the misinformationists behind this using every tool available to them.
There's more of Kimberly's interview with Steve Grobman, including tips on how to avoid giving to fraudulent fundraisers. Check it out at the Marketplace Tech tab at marketplace.org. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media Network.